Okay. Very good. So, as usual, let's review a little bit what we did yesterday, or at least where we ended yesterday. So, we had our recipe for a theory of quantum gravity, right? And we were putting check marks on our recipe. And yesterday we concluded saying that our theory contains Einstein gravity. And the way we found that was very surprising. We said that the Wall-Shift theory requires conformal symmetry, and in the presence of backgrounds, we found conditions. Well, we only did it for the metric, really. And then, if you want, you can try to do it as an exercise. But I said that it would be a very long exercise to show that the full beta function of these couplings would happen to be. So yesterday we just did it when we only had the metric and we didn't have the B field and the dilaton. But if you include everything, you find something of this form. Okay. And similar equations for the beta functions associated to the B field and to the dilaton. And then we said that in our theory, we have to impose necessarily as a consistency condition that these beta functions vanish. And I made the claim that these equations can actually be integrated, or that they actually come from an action. So this is something that was very surprising, because as we know very well, just random equations of motion will not necessarily come from an action. And so the claim I made yesterday was that these ones do, and they come from an action of the form. Okay? Very good. Now, you would say, well, this action looks a little bit strange. We're not familiar with having something here multiplying the Ricci scalar, okay? Well, in fact, you can perform a change of a field transformation, a field redefinition, so that you can remove this and leave this just as the standard Ricci scalar, okay? But sometimes it's useful to keep it like this, and when you see an action written in this form, people talk about this as being the string frame. And when you perform a field redefinition so that you get rid of this factor, and you just put it in here, just as a standard R, that would be the Einstein frame. Okay, so this is the string frame, and the Einstein frame is the one that you're familiar with. Now, we also discussed a little bit how these guys happen to be coupled to the string. So we did it. We talked about the Wall-Shift action, and we said that we had something of this form. The coupling to the metric was something like this. We also had the coupling to the B field. So here we have and the last one was the coupling to the dilaton. Okay. Note that this alpha prime is there to cancel this guy here. Okay. And this, well, just on dimensional grounds, that had to be there. Now, there is something remarkable that has to happen for the whole consistency of the theory to be true. We can start to study this action and try to perform perturbation theory and try to compute S-matrix elements of this theory. Okay? Now, what is a coupling? Well, you would say that the coupling is this guy in front here, but know that any shift in phi by a constant will shift what we mean by the coupling, okay? Because this is an overall factor, and it doesn't change the kinetic term. Very good. So, in particular, yes.
Sorry, can you just clarify, what is this actually? Is this the Einstein thing?
Okay, very good.
Sorry,
that's a good question. So I did it on that blackboard on purpose. So this is the blackboard for the space-time. And this is a blackboard for the world shape. So imagine this is a two-dimensional world in bit. And this blackboard somehow happens to be 26 dimensional.
Yes. I just don't understand. What do you mean by string frame, and then below it says Einstein frame?
Yes. So I said that this is a string frame, but this is not what you're familiar with. What you're familiar with is an action that looks like this. Sorry, I forgot. Square root of minus g here. You're familiar with an action like this, right? And this is the string frame. When you perform a field redefinition to bring this into this form, it's called, the Einstein frame.
Okay.
For obvious reasons, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a string frame because it's a natural form, it comes from the string. And this is called this Einstein frame because this is a natural form that you write the Einstein Hilbert action. Okay? So you can go from one to the other by a field redefinition. So we were saying that if you rescale phi, if you shift phi, you can change what you mean by the coupling constant here. Okay. In particular, if you say that phi has some expectation value, okay, well, then you can consider your theory around that expectation value. And that expectation value will come out of here, and it will produce a factor of the form e to the 2 phi in front of the action. Okay? So that's the reason why we think about the coupling of the theory, or the dimensionless coupling of the theory, to be e to the phi. Okay? So this will be the coupling. And we can do perturbation theory and compute S-matrix elements. Now, if we want to do the same thing on the wall sheet, what do we have to do? Well, let's take phi to be a constant, replace it by its expectation value. So what do we get? If we replace this guy by its expectation value, we pull it out times 1 over 2 pi this integral. And what did we say this was? The square root of minus h everywhere. The Euler characteristic of the wall shape. Okay? Very good. Now, when we quantize this object, we can choose to do a path integral quantization, and the path integral would be something of the form but imagine that I call this piece SG, the coupling to the metric, the coupling to the D field, and the coupling to the Hilbert. Okay? So the total action that I have to put in my path integral is the sum of the three. Okay? But now you see something interesting. This guy here just becomes this quantity. So I can pull it out. So I get e to the minus 5
the Euler characteristics of our world shape. Okay. Now the world shape can only be a two-dimensional object, right? So let's assume that we're doing the closed string. So this two-dimensional object will be, and we're doing an oriented. We are just restricting to oriented surfaces. So do you know how two-dimensional oriented surfaces, closed surfaces, are classified? That's a very standard result that we all learned and we're happy with that. They are classified by the genus, right? Very good. So we can put here, this is an integration over, so of course I should put it here. This is a world shape. But I don't have a space for more indices, so let me put it here. Okay. So this world shape can be one of the two-dimensional, one of the possible two-dimensional oriented closed surfaces. So the first one we know is a sphere. The next one, of course, is a torus, and so on, where we increase the number of handles, okay, which is also known as the genus of the Riemann surface. And what is the Euler characteristic for each of these guys? Well, it happens to be related to the genus by a very simple formula, where this is now the genus. It's not the G that I have over there. It's just unfortunate that it's a standard to call that G, and this is also G. But now imagine that we're doing these partition functions on the sphere. So the overall factor that we get will be e to the minus phi times 2. When we do the same partition function on the torus, we get e to the minus phi times 0. And here e to the minus phi times minus 2. Okay? Now let me pull this factor out and actually replace e to the minus phi by that definition g over there. So you get 1 over g squared. I get a factor 1 times the result from the partition function plus g squared times the result from doing the partition function on this world shape, and so on. Okay? Now we find that this looks like a perturbation theory of something. Well, it so happens to be the perturbation theory that you get when you study the full quantum theory. Well, there will be corrections here too. But if you keep everything to leading order in alpha prime, so you see, in each of these expansions, we have a quantum theory whose coupling constant happens to be related to alpha prime. So we can have perturbation theory for each of these guys in alpha prime, but we can also have a perturbation theory in this coupling, which is called the string coupling. Okay? So it's a very non-trivial fact that if you calculate here a three-level amplitude, that such a thing has to be computed by this object, by this quantity here. Okay? So that's a very important consistency condition, and in fact it happens to be true. Okay? Any questions about this? Yes. You were first? Who was first?
I can wait.
Let's start from.
What is the thing that you're taking the genus of? Is it the world shape?
This is a world shape. Remember.
Okay, just.
But it's not space time here. This is the blackboard for the world shape. Yes. Yes. There were questions here.
Yeah. You've got to have e to the two average phi.
Yeah, there's
the minus 2 average of 5. Is there not going to be a problem with one of those?
Sorry?
Shouldn't there be a problem with one? How can you have e to the positive exponential and e to the negative exponential in a series? One of them should blow up, shouldn't it?
Here? No, the expectation value is a number, right?
Yeah.
So that number will happen to be related to the... From this,
we identify that number as being related to this, to the coupling in a perturbative expansion. Okay? And the perturbative expansion is controlled by the genus of the world shape.
And so I know like Carl Bender's telling us how like these series tend to diverge, but that looks quite divergent against the PT.
This series?
Yeah, because if you keep changing the genus, then the number becomes more and more positive in the exponents.
Yes, indeed. When you do a perturbation expansion, right? Remember, this G is not the same as this one, of course.
All right.
That's not your confusion. Your confusion is that what you're saying is that this G, the power will keep increasing, right? Well, but if we keep G to be very small, then that quantity actually gets smaller and smaller as we go deeper in the perturbation theory.
Yeah, I know. My confusion is like in the brackets there next to the G squared. Say, is that are you putting that E? Yeah.
Yeah.
Below that.
Yeah. So this thing here.
Yeah.
Is chi for each of the surfaces, right?
Okay.
So chi from here. Right. So chi happens to be 2 here, 0, minus 2, and so on. Right. So that number indeed will become minus a billion at some point.
Yes.
That's true. And that will give rise to a term which is g to the corresponding power. And that will be a term very deep in the perturbative expansion. Right? Like when you do QED, right, and you compute some quantity in perturbation theory, you can go as high as you want. Of course, the series will not converge even in QED, right? But it's an asymptotic series. Is that clear?
Yeah.
So, of course, if the coupling happens to be of order 1, we are in trouble, right? So nothing that we're doing here makes any sense. Yes. Yes, depending on the expectation value. Yeah, you can be in trouble or you cannot be in trouble. So there are situations where you cannot avoid it, and it turns out that the theory tells you that there are regions in space-time. There could even be regions in space-time where the expectation value will just happen to be such that the coupling will be very, very large. Then you will be in trouble. Okay? Then you need something else. Perturbation theory will not help you. Okay. Yes?
Sorry. So these things you've drawn there are world shapes.
Yes.
But they're like closed. I mean, they're periodic in both directions.
Yes, that's a very good question. So what I've been doing here is Euclidean version of a ball shape. So it's Euclidean version of a ball shape that, yeah. So we skip a few steps.
Yeah.
So what we're computing here is a partition function of Euclidean theory. Okay. So in the Euclidean theory, imagine that you have a Euclidean plane, but you have conformal invariants. So that would be equivalent to a sphere. Very good. Okay.
So sorry, did you then,
yes,
by recrotating, you made the time cyclic so that the world sheet looks...
No, you see, what I'm doing, what I'm basically doing is the following. I'm now taking the world sheet. Yeah. I want to think about this as world shapes where I'm going to be doing so imagine for the closed string, we know by a conformal transformation we can make it into a cylinder, right? So it's basically a cylinder. By a conformal transformation we can send the point at minus infinity and plus infinity to finite points, right? So we can transform that into basically a plane where one of the minus infinity is at the origin and plus infinity is still at infinity on that plane, right? Now, what I want to do is to think about those points as being points where I can insert something we haven't discussed yet, which are called vertex operators, which are the way we insert physical states on the wall shape in order to compute scattering amplitudes. Okay? We haven't done that. This here is only meant for you to hear these words, because we're not really going to use all this at the moment. This is only for you to hear these words, literally that. Yeah. Because we haven't built technology to compute the scattering amplitudes yet. Okay.
But all those are very good questions. This is very good. So if we wanted to compute the scattering amplitudes to make sure that this actually reproduces the perturbation theory there, we would have to find ways of inserting into this strings that actually come, interact, and produce other strings. Okay. Yeah. But I don't want to do that now. Okay. What I want to do is to go to the next step in our recipe for a theory of quantum gravity. Okay. Do you remember what was the next step?
Interactions with gravity.
It was to make sure that you can actually put matter fields in there, right, from the standard model. After all, you want to go to the standard model at some point. Right? Now, of course, you would say, well, our theory is 26-dimensional, right? So what do you mean by why would you even worry about the standard model at this point if you didn't even have, if you don't even have four dimensions, right? So this is our last step. So the first worry might be that the dimension is 26, but of course, Kaluza-Klein actually thought about having extra dimensions as a way of explaining things in physics. Okay, and I believe you have studied Kaluza-Klein compactifications, at least from 5 dimensions to 4 dimensions. Okay, so in principle, you could say, well, maybe I shouldn't worry too much about 26. At least it's not less than 4. If it was less than 4, I might be in trouble, because nobody has talked about uncompactification. That could actually happen, but. It's actually easier to go down than to go up, okay? But there is a more pressing problem, I would say. What's the more pressing problem? What is there? In the standard model, there are gauge fields, and we found that open strings have gauge fields, so we're done. That sounds great. What is there in the standard model that we don't have here? Fermions. So we're in deep trouble. How on earth can we produce fermions? From what we have, I don't see any way we can get fermions in space-time. Okay. Well, that's something that people worried about and tried to see what to do. So what's the natural step to do? The natural thing to do is to say, well, if you want fermions in space-time, perhaps the first thing to do is to add fermions on the Wolf ship. Okay? If you don't have fermions on the Wolf ship, it sounds very, very hard to find fermions in space-time. So actually now, let me say that we're going to break our rule. Now that half of the black hole will also happen to be Wolf ship. Okay. And today we're going to study the Ramon Nabiu-Schwarz model. Okay. Also known as the Fabinet model. So what do we do? Remember, we had our action. Let me use a normalization where here the tension happens to be where alpha prime happens to be 1. So this was our action, and we did a lot of things with it. Yes?
Where do we have vector fields?
Where do we have?
Vector fields.
The gauge potentials, you mean? The gauge boxes?
Yes.
Yeah, remember when we quantized the open string, we found a massless state, and in fact, it was from there that we were able to find what little a was, this normal ordering ambiguity. Do you remember we found that a had to be 1 just to make that object that was a vector from the point of view of SO24
that guy could only come from an SO25,1 representation that was massless. Right? So we had to set A, Eta A equals to 1. Okay? And that guy is a gauge boson. Only has transversal degrees of freedom. Transverse degrees of freedom. So that's not a problem. You might say, well, but you need many, right? And you also need them to interact. Well, but that could be a range. I don't think that should be something that worries you as much as not having fermions. Okay? Well, so let's call this X. That's X. So we're going to add to this an action for fermions. Okay? What can we write? Well, the natural generalization of what we know in four dimensions. Okay. So what is this? Well, we have to give different names to the gamma matrices in two dimensions in order not to get confused. So people like to call the gamma matrices, well, you see, they shouldn't be called gamma matrices. So the Dirac matrices in two dimensions, people like to call them rho. Okay. So that's what we mean by this. Now, what's the important property that these matrices have to satisfy? They satisfy an algebra. What's the name of the algebra? A Clifford algebra. And you must be experts by now, because in last week's tutorial, just for no reason whatsoever, you spent the whole afternoon studying spinors in many dimensions, in any number of dimensions, right? So now you know the reason, or part of the reason. Okay, they satisfy this. Now, in two dimensions, there happens to be a two-dimensional representation with all real matrices. Okay. Now, this is very nice, because then we can take our spinors to be Majorana. Which means that when we consider the dagger, all we're doing is really taking the transpose, because they are real. Okay? In this representation, they just happen to be real. Now, what is psi bar? Well, you should all know by heart, because it's exactly the same definition as in four dimensions. Psi dagger. I rho 0, right? But now psi dagger is the same as psi transpose. So this is all looking very easy. Okay. Okay, let's stand the wall sheet to this part of the blackboard. Yeah, and I think for the rest of today, we're only going to be doing the wall shift. Okay, so don't worry about space time. Okay, what is the analog of gamma 5 in two dimensions? You remember what gamma 5 was in four dimensions? That should be the first question. In four dimensions, yeah, it was a product of all the guys. In two dimensions, it also happens to be the same. But of course, we're not going to call it gamma 5. We want to call it rho. And this guy happens to be this matrix. So that means that there is something interesting about our two-dimensional spinners. Now, of course, here, you see, the notation is going to get complicated at some point. So we'll have to simplify the notation a little bit. And I already did it here without telling you. But what we're going to do is precisely the analog of what we did with the wall sheet. So we introduce scalar fields that were vectors with respect to the space-time Lorentz group. Now, these spinors we're going to introduce, we also want them to be, guess what, vectors with respect to the space-time Lorentz group. Okay? Now, of course, we could put a nu here and put an eta mu nu here.
But that would make the notation more complicated. And we could just remember that they are vectors, and that when you don't see any indices, they are being contracted with eta minimum. How about that? Is that a reasonable convention? Okay. But when we have a single spinner and it's not being contracted, let's write the index explicitly. Okay? So if you see that guy, and then I ask you, what is that object from the point of view of the wall shape? What would be the answer? From the point of view of the wall shape Lorentz group. The wall shape Lorentz group, it would be spinner. With respect to the space-time Lorentz group, what is it? It's a vector. Okay. So don't let anybody fool you when they say, oh, this object, I got this nice object, it's a vector. No, you have to say, no, wait a minute, tell me with respect to what, right? So now you know that things can be very different things depending on the group you're talking about. Okay. So this guy happens to be a two-component object, right? We're in a two-dimensional representation. Now, you see, this is a matrix that defines the chirality in two dimensions. So this means that the top component of this guy has one chirality, and the bottom component has a different chirality. So people like to say that this is something that has minus chirality, okay? And this is something that has plus chirality. So when we have objects of different chirality, we talk about them as bias spinners. Now, this is something that doesn't happen in four dimensions, as you know very well, right? What is the thing that can happen in two dimensions that doesn't happen in four? Do you remember from last week? From the tutorial? Well, here is the question. Can you have Majorana-Weyl fermions? Or Majorana-Weyl spinners? In four dimensions? No, it's impossible to have both. But here we just did. Okay? So these psi minus and psi plus are Majorana-Weyl spinners on the wall sheet. Okay. Now this plus and this minus is kind of begging you to do something, to change coordinates on the wall sheet, right? It's begging you to change coordinates to which coordinates? Somehow begging you to remember that there were nice coordinates called the Lycom coordinates on the wall sheet. Now, in terms of these coordinates, remember, very nice things happen, so we can expect that the same thing will happen here.
I just don't understand why do you want the fermion to carry the Lorentz index rather than the chirality.
Well, the reason is that I don't know how to do it. I wouldn't know how to write an action that happens to be conformal invariant in that way. So we'll just have to make do and do whatever I know how to do.
Okay, this may be the fact that the fermions are basically.
Sorry, the fact that.
The fact that the fermions that we. Is basically a choice, right?
Yes.
Because we can.
Yes, that's right.
Choose a vector.
Yes. Okay, very good. You might say, well, I'm sure you're going to be in trouble because how can you possibly produce fermions in space-time if you are only starting with things that are vectors? Yeah, good. Yeah.
I won't answer that question at the moment. But I'll ask you to trust me that we're not wasting our time. Hopefully we will find fermions somehow in space-time.
Okay.
Let's go to the light cone coordinates. In the light cone coordinates, it so happens that the action actually simplifies this very nicely. Okay? So it's just a simple exercise to change coordinates and write down the action that we had that I wrote before. But now, for these guys here, and then what you'll find is something very interesting. Well, I hesitate to use our... Yeah, well, yes. Remember, here we're using our very special notation, right? Where the mu index is contracted and not shown. So that's what you will find if you did the exercise, which I encourage you to do, of using the definition of the row matrices, plug them into the action, and use this definition for psi and psi bar, and psi plus, psi minus and psi plus. Okay? And remember that in the action ends up being just psi transpose, the transpose of this. So really, the only work that you have to do is to compute this in the new coordinates. And then you will find that this is the action. Now, what are the equations of motion, or the field equations? Well, the field equations for this look very, very simple, right? They are basically telling you that psi plus can only depend on sigma plus, and psi minus can only depend on sigma minus. Okay? So can we just go ahead and find the modest functions of these guys? So I'm breaking my rule. Remember I said that whenever the guys were not contracted, I was going to show the index. Okay? So here are the indices. So if you see me breaking my rule, please let me know. So we're following exactly the same steps as we did with the scalar fields x mu. So what was the next step we did, right? We want to find solutions to these equations. What did we do in the case of the x fields? Yes, what? Yeah, we wanted to expand on Fourier modes, but would we find what else? What else? What data we need in order to be able to expand them on Fourier modes?
Boundary conditions.
The boundary conditions, excellent. Yeah, boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions came from the variation of the action. Okay. By using the equations of motion, well, we found. If you vary the action, you can read out what the equations of motions are. But remember, in doing that, we integrate by parts. Okay? Yeah, maybe we can just do it. Yeah, let's just do it. Okay. Let's take the variation on the first one. The second term will be exactly the same. So let's just look at this one. So what do we do? This looks like something we like, but this one doesn't look like something we like, so we integrate by parts. So we get minus right, plus a total derivative . Oops, but we seem to be in trouble, right? Doesn't this look like zero? How come?
Sorry?
Yeah.
But they anti-commute. So good thing they anti-commute. Okay. So they anti-commute. So this is the same as plus. And from here we get our equation of motion. That is this one. But we get this boundary term. Well, it's not yet a boundary term. It will become a boundary term, okay? So remember, this guy is tau minus sigma, okay? We usually take variations at plus or minus infinity in time to vanish, okay? So we don't worry about these variations. The ones that will come from this term, we don't worry about them. But we have to worry about these guys because this direction is compact, okay? So we're only going to be considering maybe the open string, and we might make some comments about the closed string later on. But let's just concentrate on open strings. So what do we have? We have that the boundary term will be something that comes from integrating from 0 to pi d sigma, sigma, psi plus, delta plus. Okay? Of course, we still have the integral in time. Now this thing will end up giving us sigma equals pi minus plus delta plus at sigma equals 0. Okay, but I only did this bit. If I did this, I'll get exactly the same thing. Except that there will be a minus sign. Remember, everything will be done with sigma plus. But when I do it with sigma plus, I'll get a plus sign here. So the contribution from the second term, from the dot, dot, dots, it will give me a contribution of the form minus plus delta minus. Okay? So is the reason for the minus sign clear? Why there is a relative minus sign? The reason is that now for the second term I have sigma plus, sorry, delta plus, and I have delta minus here. And when I do this step, in the first case, I got minus sigma, and in the next step, I'll get plus sigma. So there is a relative minus sign. Is that clear? Okay. Very good. Now, this is an open string. So we wouldn't want to impose conditions where this has to vanish and this has to vanish, right? Because that would say that sigma, what happens at sigma equals to 0 talks to what happens at sigma equals to pi. So we don't want to do that because it's an open string. But what can we do? Well, we can declare that something happens at sigma equals to pi. That we're free to do. And that something else happens at sigma equals to 0. That we're also free to do. Okay. So what are the boundary conditions we have to impose? We want to impose that this vanishes at sigma equals to pi, and at sigma equals 0. So those are our boundary conditions. Now you can see here we're going to have a lot of fun because there will be many ways of satisfying these conditions. Okay. Well, how can we satisfy the conditions? Well, clearly,
the way to do it, a simple way to do it, is to say that this field that depends on tau at sigma equals to pi happens to be, well, actually it could be anything. It would be plus or minus psi minus at tau at sigma equals to pi. Okay? If we pose these conditions, any of the two, this will be zero. On this side, we get the same thing. So at zero, it could be plus minus psi minus at zero. Okay. Now, of course, the overall sign of the fermionic field is not physically relevant, so we can always rescale things and impose one of the two on one side. But once we do that, then we have to be careful, because then the other sign becomes meaningful. Okay? So here we can choose. So this is a convention. The convention is to say that we're going to choose plus at the end where sigma is equal to zero. Okay. Very good. Now, having done that, we have two choices for the boundary conditions at sigma equals to pi. Okay. And each choice has a name. So the first choice, which is choosing a plus sign at sigma equals to pi, is called the Ramon boundary conditions, or people also call it the R conditions. Okay. Very good. Now we have our boundary conditions, so we should be able to write these in oscillator modes. Okay. So the oscillator expansion. Remember, sigma psi plus should only depend on sigma plus, because those are the equations of motion, right? Remember, the equation of motion was that the derivative with respect to sigma minus of psi plus was zero. So we get something that looks like this. So we have a general expansion. The oscillator modes are usually called V. Sigma plus. Let me write psi minus, and then we will check that they satisfy the condition that we need. The square root of 2 is just a convention. Okay? Now, from the boundary condition, we learn that the oscillators will have to be connected to each other. We cannot just choose, well, we could do it, say prime here. And put a prime. Okay. Now, by imposing this condition, we see that the oscillators end up being locked to each other. Okay. So it's the same set. And moreover, we see that precisely with this modus function, when we set sigma equals to pi, we get on this side a contribution that looks of the form minus 1 to the n. And on this side, we get minus 1 to the n. Well, at sigma equals to pi. And therefore, these guys satisfy the boundary condition at sigma equals to pi. At sigma equals to 0, it's obvious that they satisfy the condition, because sigma drops out and the two expressions become identical. So at sigma equals to 0, it's obvious. Okay? Now we said that this was called the RNS string, or the RNS model. Now we know where the R comes from. You can guess what the name of the other boundary condition happens to be. The second boundary condition was when we choose these guys to be related like this with a minus sign. Remember, we are always keeping, at sigma equal to zero, we are always keeping the same boundary condition with a plus sign. Okay? We should always keep in this, should always keep this in mind. So what's the name of these boundary conditions? N. We only have two boundary conditions. And we have three names. So this one better be the W. Schwarz boundary. Or NS boundary conditions. Okay? Now in this case, we have the oscillator expansion will be of the form, again, normalization. It's not very important. Now here comes something tricky. In order to satisfy this condition, we'll have to do something special. Well, these oscillators are called B. They have an index R. Let me put here, sorry, this was a plus. So what do you think we have to do to R for this thing to satisfy these boundary conditions? Sigma minus. Well, let's actually write this basically. Tau plus sigma and tau minus. So what do we need R to be for this to satisfy the Navier-Schwarz boundary conditions? Anyone? Clearly, if R is an integer, then we go back to the R boundary conditions. So are there any values of R for which this boundary condition will be satisfied? Well, here is a claim. Nobody makes a claim. Yeah, it would have to be a rational number, but what?
Half.
Which? Yeah, excellent. Half integers. Very good. Okay. So this all looks very good. But we know that this was not the end of the story, right? When we did the bosonic part of the string, finding the oscillator modes was only the beginning of the whole story, in fact. What do we have to do now? Everything has been classical at the moment, right? We found the classical equations of motion. We satisfy the boundary conditions. Everything is classical. So we have to quantize. And today, I'm completely sure that we started 5 minutes late, so we can actually keep going. Any questions up to this? Okay.
Can we see at this point that we have problems in space time?
No. Well, so remember, in the bosonic case, we found the fields in space-time after we quantized, and we started to see the Hilbert space, the physical Hilbert space. And by seeing what the vacuum was and how the oscillators were creating states, we were able to see the transformations that they had under the Lorentz group in space-time. And we concluded that they were a tachyon, yeah, too bad, then massless fields that we found, okay, and then a tower of massive guys. Well, we would expect that the same thing happens here. We have to wait until we quantize it to see what we get in space-time. Okay. Well, let's actually do so. Yeah, because I think you won't be able to sleep tonight without knowing if you can get fermions in space-time, right? And at least you shouldn't. And it's too stressing. Too stressful to actually not know what happens. So let's quantize this thing. Okay, so the first step we did for the bosonic part was to find the boson brackets for the classical fields. So we can do the same thing for the psi fields, for the fermionic fields. And you find that the classical boson brackets, the equal time boson brackets, happen to be the following. Remember, the reason there is a psi here, in the same way as there is here, is that you're supposed to compute the conjugate variable to psi, but in this case, it so happens to be itself. Okay. Well, you see that we're heading towards the same disaster as last time. Right? Because of our metric sitting there. But, well, let's just continue and see what happens. From here, when we promote these to be the quantum and the commutation relations, we can read off what the commutation relations for the oscillator modes, the B's in an unusual sector, and the D's in the Ramon sector. Okay? So let's do one of them. So the D's will end up satisfying we'll have the same condition as last time. Oh, this is important. Why do we have this condition here? Do you remember what happened in the string? Yes.
These boson brackets are anti-commutators?
Yes, these are anti-commutators.
So these are like,
remember, the classical limit of a fermionic field, what it is? The classical limit of a, when we take the classical version of a bosonic field, it's just a bunch of commuting numbers, right? A bunch of complex numbers in general. When you take the classical limit of a fermionic field, what do you get? Well, you get Grassmann numbers. Right? Now, the question was, in the case of the bosonic fields, in the case of x mu, why did we get this condition? It was?
A reality condition.
We said that x mu was a real field because we wanted real coordinates in space-time, and that ended up giving us a condition between the oscillators. So x being real, as an operator meant this. And therefore, we had to impose a condition on the oscillators. We had to say that okay. Now here, our fermions are Majorana, so they are also real. So we also have to satisfy a condition. So the condition is, again, the same sort of condition. Okay. And the same thing for the B's. And that's the reason the only interesting anti-commutator is when you have n plus n equals to 0. Okay? So the same thing will happen for the Bs. Now, you see the notation. People like to call R and S half integers and N and M integers. So it's just to remind ourselves what the indices are supposed to be. Okay. Now, since we don't have much time, let's just quickly look at the vacuum. So let's consider our boundary conditions. Okay. So we have these oscillator modes. And we want to consider what happens to our vacuum. And remember, the simplest definition of the vacuum would be a state where we apply all these oscillators. And we get zero. Let's remove this index. Momentum label for the moment. So it's a state in the Hilbert space where we get zero. Okay. But there is something interesting too that happens, which is that, remember, let's have a look at these guys here and set n and m to zero. What do we find? Okay. The D0 oscillators happen to look like what? What kind of algebra this is? It almost looks like a Clifford algebra. If it was only If we only had a factor of 2, we would get a Clifford algebra. So I'll let you suffer tonight. Okay. So you see, we see a Clifford algebra already in space time. That's incredible. Out of nowhere, you see a Clifford algebra in space time. Now, if you see a Clifford algebra in space time, what is likely to happen? You're going to see spinor representations. Okay, so your job, maybe that would be a homework. So try to find out who's going to be the fermion in space-time. Okay. Tomorrow we will do it, but try to think about that tonight. Okay. Now, just a few words about this, the tutorial today. You see, we wrote down this RNS model as the most natural thing that you can imagine as a generalization. We know the Dirac action from four dimensions. We didn't make any efforts to make any other interesting representation in space-time. We only chose to be the spinor of the vector representation. So we just wrote a very simple action. Okay? But we didn't do something that I did the very first day when we wrote down the bosonic action. And do you remember what we did? We studied the symmetries, the global symmetries of the action. We didn't do that today. You should have complained. Said, excuse me, there is something we haven't done, which is to study that. And then, if you had said that, my reply would be, don't worry, you're going to do it in the tutorial. Okay? So in the tutorial, you will find a global symmetry of this action, which was actually discovered. It was actually the first example of such a thing. I'll leave it after that. So you will do it in the tutorial. Okay. Let's stop for today.